We're talking about raising a child with intellectual and developmental disabilities into adulthood on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Do you have a child with disabilities? Do you worry they'll have a hard time living independently as an adult? What are some of the challenges you see? Have you started making arrangements for the next phase in life? We're at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Wisconsin has a shortage of quality, affordable housing, but people with disabilities often have even fewer options. WPR reporter Phoebe Petrovic talked to one group of parents taking unusual steps to help their children with disabilities finding housing tailored to their needs.
On a Tuesday in Mount Horeb, five women have gathered at a cafe table crowded with coffee cups and thick binders.
Why don't you talk about your homework?
So my homework is...
Today, they're talking about grant applications. Some are specific.
Oh, here's the one. Do not use grant funds on posters and excessive begging.
The group needs to raise $500,000 to help build an apartment complex they're calling Home of Our Own. These parents and grandparents all have adult children with disabilities who still live with them. The group's leaders, Marianne Omakin and Susan Wallach, met over 20 years ago when their children, Amy and Frank, were in preschool. Amy and Frank both have autism and are nonverbal. Wallach says she and Omakin often spoke about their children's futures.
What happens when our children grow up, and where are they going to live, and what are their lives going to look like? Because we know these are not going to be children who are going to be independent someday.
Amy and Frank are now in their mid-20s and still live with their parents. But Omakin knows their children can't live with them forever.
Let's face it, we are going to die one day. And we would much rather plan thoughtfully and to not have the planning be driven by a crisis.
The parents worry about what will happen when they're no longer able to care for their children. And they say they don't want to put them in group homes or isolated apartments, worrying it might expose them to abuse. People with intellectual disabilities experience sexual assault at a rate 7 times that of those without disabilities, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. So Omakin says that for the past 6 years, the families behind Home of Our Own have met weekly, trying to figure out how to build a place where their children can live on their own, safely and affordably, among friends and neighbors in rural Wisconsin.
This is a really, really determined set of parents, and we just refused to give up.
They dreamed up a specific plan, an integrated community in small-town New Glarus, welcoming residents of all abilities and incomes. Disability advocates, nonprofit developers, and state officials all say there is a shortage of affordable, accessible housing in Wisconsin. Even without a detailed wish list, it's slim picking, says Jason Belongi, Assistant Director of Access to Independence, which serves people of all disabilities and ages in South Central Wisconsin.
There's a very significant shortage of housing stock that is both affordable and accessible for people with disabilities.
In the past few years, the state has seen an increased demand for supportive housing, like Home of Our Own, where some residents get assistance from caretakers. That's according to the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. David Ginger oversees their allocation of tax credits for affordable developments.
I suspect I could allocate all my tax credits to supportive housing for the next couple of years and still not make a huge dent into the need.
Home of Our Own has applied for these tax credits, which would largely cover the $8 million project. They've also gotten approval from New Glarus. They have secured a plot of land and drawn up building designs. Omakin says they're getting closer.
Oh my gosh. In some ways, it feels like this has been the longest journey of our lives. But in other ways, it feels like all of a sudden it's moving really quickly.
It's been tough, but Susan Wallach, the group's other leader, says their children have kept them going.
Our children are the most amazing teachers, and they're the most remarkable people. And if we are strong, it is because our children have taught us to be strong.
If the parents succeed, they'll create 40 new homes in Wisconsin. But advocates say there are still thousands of people needing quality, affordable, accessible housing. And to answer that need, it'll take more than just a few dedicated parents. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're having a discussion about quality, affordable housing for adults with disabilities in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. Let's bring in Marcy Brost. She is Executive Director of the Developmental Disabilities Network. That's a statewide nonprofit that supports people with disabilities by helping them achieve meaning, connection, and a good life. She's also the parent of a young man with disabilities who lives in Madison. Marcy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So you have a child with disabilities, and you worry that they'll have a hard time living independently as an adult. So as you look at your own son in Madison, and we just heard from parents who are asking these questions, are these questions that all parents face when they have children with disabilities?
Well, I do think so. At least the parents I know who have children with disabilities who are going to be adults or already adults do wonder about those things. I think for me, and probably like any number of other families, the kind of meaningful life that I am hoping he will experience is one of interdependence and not of independence. I think I've learned that from a lot of my friends who have children without disabilities, is that the perspective of independence as the ultimate goal may actually not be the real goal for any of us, but rather a really healthy, thoughtful, respectful interdependence with each other. So, yeah, I share their concerns, and I respect the long journey that each of them have taken and the journeys that lots of families are on right now.
What does interdependence mean and look like on a day-to-day basis?
I think for me, what it means is that the individual who experiences disability, regardless of what the disability is and how complex it is and what issues it presents to the person and their family and the people who support them, is that there's reciprocity and that the individual who experiences disability has an opportunity to make contributions and to have a valued social role in the community, to be employed, to be living as ordinary can be for that particular person, and to be a real citizen and to be a full citizen. That does not mean they don't need support. It just means that that's a part of their life. It's not the definition of who they are as a person.
We know there is this shortage of affordable, accessible, safe housing in Wisconsin. What kind of strain does that put on parents who want their children to be able to live more fully and be contributors, be real citizens, as you say?
Well, I think it strains people in different ways. It sounds to me like the individuals in the Nuglaris situation experienced life very similar to myself and a number of other families when our children were in their teens, and feeling like there wasn't immediately available what we wanted. So we had to step up and try to figure out, how do we partner with people? How do we make our needs known? How do we support people who are funding housing, who are developing housing, who are zoning for housing? How do we collaborate with people so that individuals who experience disability can have those options when they're adults, can find places to rent that are affordable, that have the physical accommodations that they may need, and that are in neighborhoods or locations which permit them to get to work? Have a social life, go to church.
We're talking with Marcy Brost. She's executive director of the Madison-based Developmental Disabilities Network. You have a line to this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you have a child with disabilities who you worry will have a difficult time living independently as an adult? Does it take an emotional toll on you and your family, and you don't think people talk about it enough? And housing aside, what other types of struggles do you face as you try to create the best possible future for your child with disabilities? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. When we come back, we'll learn about a Wisconsin nonprofit that works to provide a range of housings. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about housing for people with disabilities on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The statewide nonprofit housing organization called Movin' Out helps adults with disabilities achieve homeownership or rent an apartment, and has been working on this for well over 20 years. We're looking at the challenges families face as they try to find affordable, quality housing options. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your school or community doing right when it comes to integrating your child into activities, the workforce, and other aspects of daily life? What are some of the issues you see in helping an adult child with disabilities have a secure future? We've been talking with Marcy Brost, who stays with us. She heads up the Developmental Disabilities Network. And now let's bring in Catherine Auerbeck to the conversation. She's executive director of Movin' Out, which provides housing options for adults with disabilities and for families that have children with disabilities. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we are hearing from parents who are having a really difficult time and trying to build affordable housing to accommodate their adult children. They're going at it on their own. So what do you think their experiences tell us about the state of affordable housing for adults with disabilities here in Wisconsin?
They're facing a challenge that parents and families across the state are facing. There really isn't enough quality, affordable housing to meet the demand, even for people who are not experiencing disabilities, and to find quality, affordable housing that offers that kind of accessibility that may be needed and that is coordinated with supportive services is an even greater challenge.
When you look at rural versus urban, are there particular parts of the states where this type of housing is particularly sparse?
It definitely, I think, is a bigger challenge in the more rural communities. These are areas where, you know, the housing stock in general, again, is can be a challenge, and families with a family member with disabilities may have fewer choices in rural communities, although Movin' Out has worked in many rural communities across the state, and we are working on a new project now in Platteville that is community-integrated, high-quality, mixed-income rental housing, where about 25% of the units will be supportive units.
And when you say community integrated, what does that mean?
That means that the supportive units or units that are designated for people with disabilities or other status like veteran status are not in any way clustered. That's one of the founding principles of Movin' Out. The parents, including Marcy, who was one of the founding parents of our organization, felt very strongly, and their children's preferences mattered a great deal. And that was, as Marcy said earlier, that ability to live as a full citizen and contribute to the community, that for us is hinges on housing that's fully mixed in with the rest of the community, that's not segregated or clustered in any way.
Marcy, the parents behind Home of Our Own said they didn't want to put their children in group homes. What is a group home situation like, and what are your concerns with that?
Well, from my perspective, I know that there's great variability across the state. I mean, to me, a group home is a licensed setting where individuals, usually but not always, who have some similarities in disability labels are clustered. My point of view is that that's segregation, and that's a violation of any number of legal rights people have. I just think that it interferes with people having opportunities to be ordinary citizens in the community. I know there are people who disagree with me. It's just not a model that I think supports the real high-quality interdependence and integration that we want in our communities. And I think that people have better odds of becoming full citizens and having opportunities to try things out when the supports they get are more tailored, and when they're in settings that are more tailored and more individualized. For me, I can only speak for myself, having a license does not necessarily decrease my fear or increase my comfort level about the quality of support that people would be getting. I think historically that was a model that was used as institutions were downsized. And I think that at the time that was what we thought was best. And I think we're at a new time now. We have people graduating from schools, and we have people who've already graduated and whose families are wanting to have more ordinariness and more opportunities to express citizenship, and for disability to be something that people experience but does not define who they are as a person.
Catherine, Movin' Out has been around for about 27 years. How has the landscape for supportive housing changed and evolved? And was it harder to make the case for this type of housing in the early 90s?
I think we're definitely seeing a shift toward less of a one-size-fits-all approach in many parts of our society, housing being certainly one of them, and a shift away from a tendency toward institutionalization to more customized settings where people can express their preferences for their daily lives. So for us, we're definitely seeing more and more of an opportunity to create this kind of housing option for people who prefer it. And there's, you know, certainly that parallel shift in the type of funding that's available for these kinds of projects.
How cost prohibitive can it be for families who are looking for a setting that aligns with what their adult child, you know, really would like and wants to live in?
I think that if the community integrated housing is paired with supportive services through the long-term care system, that the overall cost is comparable to what a family would experience with a more institutional setting. And similar to what the healthcare system is starting to recognize, that keeping people in facilities rather than helping them get the care that they need at home is actually more expensive.
Marcy, going back to watching your son live an interdependent life and being on that journey, what have the two of you learned together through this journey?
Wow, we've had great opportunities to learn, and every day even more. I would say what we've really learned are a couple things. One is I think I've learned a great deal about resilience in terms of seeing how resilient he is, even though often I might have been concerned about his ability to live with some of the consequences of some of his disabilities. So I've really been able to get a deeper understanding and a feeling for what resilience is for someone who experiences the kinds of disabilities that he does. I think what I've really learned is that it is possible to pursue the kinds of achievements that I wanted for him and the experiences I wanted him to have. That does not in any way make light of some of the difficulties and some of the downright losses that we had when we tried different strategies or different experiences. It's not in any way did I learn that this was an easy road, but I think the other thing I really learned is I do have friends who have adult children who are in similar age to my son and their children don't have disabilities, at least yet. And some of the dilemmas that they faced with their children were different than I did with my son. But I think I really learned that the disability, the impairments that he has, definitely have a significant impact on his life. But the most important thing is that they're not a description of who he is. He is still a whole person, and that he can be quite successful. He works 4 days a week. He has had jobs in lengths of nearly 20 years. He lives in a typical house in a typical neighborhood. He participates in a variety of community activities. He's been able to volunteer. He's been able to make contributions to the community. So
it sounds like a full life.
Yes.
Marcy, yes. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Marcy Brost is Executive Director of the Developmental Disabilities Network. And Catherine Auerbach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Catherine Auerbach is Executive Director of Movin' Out. Coming up next, talking about puberty with kids is hard. Talking about it with children with disabilities is unique. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. Everybody's body changes during puberty, and for kids on the autism spectrum and their families, this time may be challenging. We're talking about puberty, relationships, and sexual health on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What can families expect when children on the spectrum reach puberty, and how can they help their teen through this time of change? We're at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent or sibling of someone with autism or an intellectual disability? What challenges and opportunities have you experienced with them throughout the years? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Melissa Dubey now. She is a research associate and educational consultant at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community. She's worked in the public school system for 18 years with students with disabilities. Melissa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate, for having me.
You found that some parents seem shocked when their child with autism begins puberty because their developmental level is that of a child, and it can be difficult to imagine they've reached this stage, but the physical maturing doesn't wait. How do you help parents prepare for this phase of their child's life?
I think they just need to start talking to their kids at an early age just about their bodies. There's lots of books just on puberty that are good for even if you don't have a disability. Start showing them pictures about how their bodies will be changing. Talk about it. Become aware of what will happen and, you know, start practicing. So,
and when you say start practicing, what can you tell parents about practicing? Because this can be a difficult thing.
Yeah, for girls, start looking at menstruating. So you practice putting like a thin pad in their underwear and make sure they understand the sticky side goes down on the underwear. Marking the underwear, like where exactly it should go with a permanent marker so that they get it in exactly the right place. You know, only wear it for like 10 minutes because, you know, when you're not menstruating, it's really it would be uncomfortable. But they could, you know, then get used to rolling it back up and putting it back into the wrapper and throwing it away. And, you know, cleaning their hands. So just gradually, you can even put like food coloring in a pad so that they understand that it's, you know, what's going to happen or what it will look like. So just small, you know, step-by-step preparation.
Yeah, you're sounding, it does sound step-by-step going through the motions, but you haven't gotten there yet. So there is practice involved.
Yes, and I think the more concrete you can make it for individuals with autism or intellectual disabilities, the better off it will be. And so you're pre-teaching exactly what's going to happen.
And what about for boys as they come to this age?
So boys, it's more about they're going to have a lot of erections and that they're unplanned. It's not that they're attracted to anyone. So they're going to have to look at the different types of underwear they're wearing. Maybe they were wearing briefs before and now they need to wear looser underwear, so boxer shorts, so that they can make, you know, make little adjustments and it's a little more comfortable. I've also had dads tell me that they tell their kids to hold a folder or a backpack in front of their, you know, the front of their pants, so that if they have, when they have erections at school, it's just, it's going to last a few minutes. This is your plan, and then you'll have a plan, or you know it's not something they have control over. So not to make it obvious, like don't hit your penis, just casually try to hide it, and or go get a drink of water, you know. So just have a slight plan. Or also, boys will have nocturnal emissions or wet dreams at night, and so what is the plan for that? Have a basket next to your bed so that you can just change your wet clothes and put on dry clothes. So just have a plan.
We're talking with Melissa Duby. She is a research associate and educational consultant at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How did you, as a family, process dating and relationships while your child with a disability grew older? What misconceptions would you like corrected for people who don't experience this on the day-to-day? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Melissa, hygiene becomes more important for all teens at this time of life. Can you talk about some strategies parents can use and language that helps teens with autism or intellectual and developmental disabilities understand and implement best hygiene practices?
Well, hygiene is sensitive because individuals with autism, they have sensory issues. And so often the smells, you could say unscented for deodorant, and unscented to a person that's really sensitive to that will still think it has a scent. So it's important to try different deodorants. So it might be buy something that, you know, three different products that are unscented. It might be gel they like. It might be powder. Might be a spray. So really exploring which kind of deodorants work. And so just exploring even for shaving. I have had four boys, they have to be desensitized to the feeling of an electric shaver. And so it helps if they put it like on their palm first, and then on the back of their hand, and then on your arm, and gradually working up to your neck so that they will be desensitized to the noise and the vibration. So part of the hygiene part is getting used to the products.
Because these products have impact on the sensory and certainly people on the autism spectrum, senses are heightened perhaps.
Exactly.
How important is it for parents to use the correct terminology for anatomy when discussing these changes with their child?
That's really important. I think it's that you need to start using penis and start using vagina. And because the reason, if you're a 42-year-old man and you say my pee-pee hurts, you know, or a girl says down there, well, where is down there? You know, but if we say my vagina itches, or it's my breasts are sore, you know, that's specific to a doctor, somebody that can be medically helpful.
And parents themselves need to be comfortable with these topics. How can parents be better prepared to answer sensitive questions and not be flat-footed?
I think that, like when I first started talking about this topic, I had to say the medical terms out loud because I was uncomfortable saying penis out loud. So I had to say it repeatedly to friends and family so that I could be comfortable. And I also would suggest that they just read books on puberty. Just go to your local bookstore or library so that they can just understand. I think I might have understood my own menstruating a process, but to make sure I understood the fallopian terms, you know, fallopian tubes or the terms that go along with shedding the liner and those kind of things, so that they're sure that they're using the proper medical terms. So the more knowledge parents have, the more knowledge that they can then share with their children.
And it seems as if you should be reading the books with the ones that you recommend for your child, or watching the videos that you are wanting your teen to watch. So that
definitely,
you know, the content as well, mm-hmm. Because oftentimes it's like, oh, here, just watch this. I already know what's going on.
Right. No, definitely. I would definitely watch it with, I'd preview it first, and then I would watch it with them for sure.
Children are going to make mistakes through this time of change, as will adults. What advice do you have for parents for when that inevitably happens, either with a child or with a parent?
I think as a parent can really be observant. They can start seeing how their child is changing. You know, like a girl usually starts her period 6 months to a year after she has breast mounds. And so, you know, start noticing, are they growing pubic hair? Are they getting taller? You know, so really understanding if the parents understand the developmental stages, then they can look for that in their child. So even if they have an intellectual disability, then they still would be able to see that, you know, the child's not going to be able to say, hey, mom, I'm, you know, it's something weird is growing, you know, down there, you know, in my vagina. So it's, I don't know really what that is. So it would be really helpful if parents are observable.
I was reading some literature in preparing for today, and it said that there is perhaps a tendency for children with autism to have seizures during this time of puberty or heightened risk of seizures. Is there anything to that?
I'm not familiar with that. I do know that as children go through puberty, their medications may need to be changed because their hormones are changing.
And children are learning in different ways. For a parent with a child with autism or an intellectual and developmental disability, it's unlikely this is the first obstacle that the family has had to tackle. Can you talk to us about how important is that for parents to develop different strategies based on their child's learning style?
I think it's really important to know their own child's learning style. So if they taught their kid how to ride a bike or use a utensil at home, if, you know, maybe they're a visual learner or they learn through videos or just concrete steps, practice and role model, whatever has worked for teaching other strategies, just think about puberty as another developmental stage. It's just a period in their life. It's a, you know, 4 or 5 years. And then you move on to another stage in your life. And so take a breath, be open-minded, have a good sense of humor, and you'll be able, anyone can get, you know, the parents will be able to get through this stage of life as well.
You've seen lots of literature, lots of books, lots of videos. Is there any one particular one that comes to mind that you've seen has just been really effective for families to use?
I think, I wrote a book with a colleague of mine. It's called Intimate Relations and Sexual Health. And so it's really written well for middle or high school to adults. And it really is to make everyone informed about all of their decisions. Another book I really like is Daffida Hartman's called Sexuality and Relationship Education for Children and Adolescents with Autism. And it's more about puberty. So it leads up to what our book is about.
Puberty can be especially difficult on teens with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families. We're looking at how to approach this time of change. Melissa Duby is our guide. She's a research associate and educational consultant at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Caregivers, what strategies have worked best to help your child cope and understand puberty? What advice would you give others? How did you as a family approach things like dating and relationships while your child with a disability grew older? What misconceptions would you like to clear up for people who don't experience this each day? You can call in at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Children with special needs move through puberty. They grow into adulthood all the same. We're exploring how to support a child with a disability during this period. Here with us on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer Kent. There are the emotional and social changes of adolescence, compounded by the hormonal, the physical changes. We're looking at how to navigate this time with your insights, your questions along the way. Are you an educator who teaches kids and teens with disabilities? What have you learned through your experience? Share with us at 800-642-1234. Are you a sex education teacher? How have you adjusted your approach for teens with different abilities? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Melissa Duby stays with us. She is our guide. She's a research associate and educational consultant at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community. Melissa, you've worked with educators and teachers in public schools to better understand and adapt to the needs of students with autism or intellectual and developmental disabilities. So what should teachers know or be aware of and be prepared for when they're teaching students at this stage?
I think it's important that whatever the education is on sexual health in the public schools, that the individuals with disabilities be included. And so every state either has an opt-in or an opt-out. And so just make sure that the parents understand the curriculum and let them preview it beforehand so that they understand that they can be included. And then so that the parents then can teach the after the curriculum to because they'll need to supplement it one time or the four or five times that it's in the health class or biology class won't be enough. So they'll need multiple ongoing conversations about sexual health.
What are some types of supplementary conversations that could be had, or how to reinforce what is being taught in the classroom?
Well, like I shared earlier, when parents are talking with their kids, it's the same thing. They're going to need to have more step-by-step instruction. We're going to need more role-playing, you know, individuals, so that it's at the specific scenarios are for meaningful for the individuals with disabilities, and so that it's practical for them. And so it's not just learning the instruction. They then have to be able to learn how to generalize the instruction within their daily lives.
Do you see teachers able to meet these students where they are, or do you find sometimes teachers are perhaps dumbing down the curriculum because they don't think that the student with a disability is going to get it?
I think that it's not that they're, I think that they're familiar with it. I think sometimes it's that they're uncomfortable. They're not really sure what to teach. And so becoming more knowledgeable themselves, just like parents are becoming more knowledgeable, will help bridge this gap.
As children become teens and they grow into adults, they may develop interests in having romantic relationships. How do you advise parents and teens with autism to approach this?
I think it's important to start with just friendships. You know, individuals with autism, one of their major deficits is understanding social relationships of any kind. And so understanding that there are stages of relationships, you know, if a person smiles at them, that doesn't mean now we're dating or going to get married. And so that's a misunderstanding for individuals with autism or individuals with intellectual disabilities. And so that we need to really understand, well, what, you know, that first you have a stranger, and there's, I think of it like a bullet, like a circles of within each other. And so the larger circle is strangers, and there's a lot of strangers in our life. And then we go to like casual acquaintances. And who are those? Those are people we just meet in the street, or we meet just at, might be at our school, but we're really not friends. And then we go to friends. Well, what do we do with friends? And how do we start meeting up with friends? And parents really have to be a part of this so that they bring the kids over to their house and that they try to initiate some of that so that the friendships can continue. But then there's friendships of, are they really friends? And teaching a hidden curriculum that about social relationships is an ongoing process. And so before you can even begin dating, is that to understand the friendship part. But then you can have casual dating, then you have romantic dating, and so before you get to even an intimate relationship. So if there's lots of stages, and to understand and define that for the individuals.
And that can get really complicated. You know, relationships are notoriously complicated and complex.
Yes, for sure.
And so it sounds like a parent has to be really, really aware of how those relationships around their child are developing.
Yeah, and involved. I have a family I'm working with right now, and the parent is bringing the friends over to their house because the student or the child really is more comfortable in their own home. And so that really helps that she's willing to have, you know, three or four kids come over to the house. And so she's the one calling the parents saying, hey, can you come over this weekend? Or, hey, but how about if we get the boys together and they go watch a movie together? So she's the one trying to get everyone to make this work.
How important is it to let them know that sexual feelings they may be having are normal?
I think it's very important. The individuals with disabilities have sexual feelings just like everybody else. And so, but then to teach them what that means. And so with our individuals that don't have disabilities, we might just give them a book and say, here you go, which I'm not supporting that. I think everyone needs to have a lesson, many, many lessons on our bodies and our relationships. But individuals with disabilities, they even need more practice with that. And so every step of the way, someone has to be teaching them a new skill for them to acquire it.
Studies have shown that adults with intellectual disabilities are sexually abused at 7 times the rate of those without disabilities. How can we teach consent to this population?
I think to start early, when we start tickling our little, 7 or 8 year olds, and they say stop, we stop. And we say, you said stop, so I'm going to respect what you have to say. And so as they get older, we say, anytime they say no, I don't want that, that we respect that. And so that we're reiterating that your words of no are important. And then we can start saying, you can tell anyone that, no, I don't want to be touched. And that we say only the people that touch where our bathing suits go. So that's a concrete visual that they can see, and we can make a diagram of that. Your bathing suit goes in these spots. And so only the people that can touch you in those spots are medical people or your caregivers. Now, a lot of sexual abusers are caregivers, so it's really important that parents know whether their child can give consent. And if they can't, then they have to be super protective. If they can, then teach them maybe a contract to say that if someone touches you in these areas, then I'm going to scream and run away, and I'm going to yell, and I'm going to go tell the person on this contract that I know I can trust. So just to be having a continual conversation about what consent is.
And it's not the person's sole responsibility to make sure they aren't abused. That, you're relying both on your parents, but also that the fact that, that child may or may not have that ability to understand consent.
Exactly, especially if you have an intellectual developmental disability, you just may not know what consent is. And so then the parent needs to be vigilant about being protective of their child.
Melissa Dubey, how has your field evolved, and where have been the real aha moments that have been able to help this area of understanding as people with disabilities grow into adults?
I think that I have a particular interest now also in intellectual developmental disabilities, and I'm on a couple grants, and we are working towards educating adult women with disabilities and understanding what their knowledge is. The research shows us that they haven't been exposed to sexual health. And so now trying to educate them as adults. And so I'm on a project that's working on making sure that they understand everything about their bodies and relationships and sexual health.
Well, Melissa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And if you have anybody needs any support, you can call or email me at Indiana Resource Center for Autism.
Melissa Dubey is a research associate and educational consultant at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community. She's worked in the public school system for 18 years with students with disabilities. Earlier, we talked with Marcy Brost, Executive Director of the Developmental Disabilities Network, and we also spoke with Catherine Auerbach, Executive Director of Movin' Out, about housing solutions for adults with disabilities and for families that have children with disabilities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This conversation comes to you on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.